Listen, take it from me. Old age and all, it's cracked up to be. The greatest advantage I can think of is that it doesn't last all that long. Now, the song I'm going to sing now is another tragic song, just like the one you just heard. And it'll come as a shock to you. What happened was, I'll tell you the whole story. Because when I decided to write music, I used to join a folk singing group and get an idea of the genre of music. And the lady who was in charge of the place suggested I go to a singer, a teacher of guitar. His name was Larry Hanks. And so I remembered the name, and I was at a party in Berkeley, and they were singing some Christmas songs. And I went up to this man, and I said, "Aren't you Larry Hanks?" And he said, "Yes." So I said, "You're supposed to teach me the guitar." So that's how I got my guitar teacher. But he was one of these somewhat protest kind of singers himself. And he said to me about my songs one day, "Well, the trouble with your songs is that they're too cheerful." So when I got home that night, I thought, well, I really ought to try to write a blues for him. And I tried but failed, so I had to call it the non-blues. And I will say for him that he enjoyed it. Okay. What am I doing hanging out in this cellar? It's like this. I'm composing a blues. No, but it ain't the blues, because it's only one. And, brother, one's all I can do. I'm hanging my head like I oughta. How's this? Oh, I got the hang of it. My chair is a case of gin. And my mouth I have drooped like a Saint Bernard till its corners are touching my chin. You may ask, why you feeling so blue? Well, I ain't. I just thought I should try. 'Cause some fella said all those songs of yours ain't for real, they don't make no one cry. So I thought, just find me some cellar. For the only way to feel blue is forget the sun and pretend the world is as dark as a fireplace through. Oh, that's realism, yeah. Love that gutter. Shit, I wonder if we ain't been misled. How much reality can a man see anyway when he sits all day hanging his head? Now it ain't that I don't know what grief is. This old heart has had its full share. But grief's one thing and complaining another. Why multiply grief with despair? For I find that this whole world around me, like a mirror upon the wall, looks blue when I'm blue, looks smiles back when I smile, looks blue when I'm blue, and that blue shade I don't like at all. I'm going back to my bad old home. My time here is almost done. The fact is, fella, I can't stand this cellar. I just gotta get out in the sun. Okay. Well, look, I'm going to sit. I hope I'm excused for it. The reason being that I think it would be embarrassing for us all if I were to topple over. My subject this morning is, has God a sense of humor? Let me read you a story from my book, Conversations with Yogananda. Paramahansa Yogananda demonstrated no respectful solemnity toward religious practices that he considered false or merely emotional rather than devotional. Indeed, he could make very merry at their expense. He once told us, laughing, about a holy roller gathering he had witnessed. They all were fat ladies, old men, all rolling about on the floor in their zeal. They thought they were being inspired by the Holy Ghost, but what really moved them was the unholy ghost of emotions. Devotion must be internalized. When allowed to flow outward, it becomes emotion. Emotional devotion, by its very exuberance, takes one further into delusion. Excitement only extinguishes the lamp of pure love. God, too, he commented, has a sense of humor. All men are his children, but why shouldn't he have fun when he sees them acting comically? Now, this raises some very interesting points, because God is the infinite spirit. He is beyond duality. Therefore, he is bound beyond reaction. There is no action or reaction. There's no minus and plus, or day or night, or cold or dark, or hot or cold or light. No contrast. And yet, isn't humor a reaction? That is an interesting philosophical point. How, if God is beyond reaction, can he have a sense of humor? The answer is that God, although not reacting, is bliss. The nature of God is bliss. We think of it as beyond human. It isn't. The more you experience of God's presence, the more you feel a real bliss inside. Please come in. It is overwhelming. And really, sometimes I feel so blissful that I just can't help weeping. And I feel so foolish, but I can't help it. It's just that the reality of your being is very different from having fun, but it's very similar too. The reality of life under everything is bliss. Now, this means that underneath all the tragedies that we experience in life, there is bliss. You know, nobody has ever found God and said, what a scam. Always the reaction at the end has been, it was worth all those incarnations of ups and downs of suffering, all those tests, all those trials, they were worth it. Because the result of it all is so perfect that nothing matters in the face of them. Now, I was reading this morning about my difficulties in this life. And I've had my share, as everybody does. But my particularly difficulties were that here I was, a relatively talented and enthusiastic young man. Yes, I was young, believe it or not. And everything I tried to do was met with opposition. In fact, I got an interesting reading in India just 2 days before I left India this year. It was the world goes through different cycles of time. We have just come out of that cycle in which mankind sees everything as solid, matter as real, dogmas as fixed, Everything has to be solid and fixed and set in place. And the world is flat. The world is the center of the universe. People's vision is limited. We are influenced much more than we realize by cosmic currents of thought. Our solar system goes around the cosmos, around our galaxy, in a certain within, because it takes over 100 million years for it to go around the whole galaxy. But there's a cycle within that in which cosmic influences us in different ways. And in that period, mankind is basically stupid. In 1900, we came out of that into an age of energy. And nowadays, all you ever hear about is energy. Well, this will go on for another 2,200 years. And then we will come into a period of where they will see that actually everything is not energy, but that energy is a manifestation of thought. And that period will go on for a total of 3,600 years. Then we enter a period when people realize that everything is God. And that will go on for a very long time, fortunately. But it's interesting to see that this thing, which to us at this point in time, looks like an interesting theory, in fact was shared by several hundred ancient civilizations. A friend of mine has done some research on this. I think he found it was over 200 ancient civilizations who believed in the ages of man. We know about the Greeks and the Egyptians. The Greeks thought that there was a golden age, a silver age, a bronze age, and an iron age. These are all symbolic for these actual facts that man was coming down at that time, and they look back to a period when people were higher. Well, here's something interesting I found in India. Most fascinating. It was supposed to have been a book written about 5,000 years ago during the mental age. During the energy age, the delusion of space is abolished. We'll be able to go to distant planets and so on. But during the Treta Yuga, the third age of mental ability, seeing everything as a thought, time will be demolished. And you can accept this or not, but I'm telling it to you as my experience. I have found two books in India, supposedly written about 5,000 years ago. And they described me, Swami Kriyananda, James Donald Walters. He said that I had been born in Romania. That's not the usual thing for an American. I grew up in America. My father named me James. It said that I have two brothers, but no sister possible. One will die in my mother's womb. And I asked my mother if she'd ever had a miscarriage, and she said yes, she had had one. It said that my name would become Kriyananda, my guru's name would be Yogananda. It spoke about various things in my future, and it said it would be a good future. But it said, I've told him now the fruits of his good karmas, but now here also is the fruits of his bad karmas. It said that there is a chance of sudden, unexpected death. And three times in my life, I've come within a centimeter of dying. One time I was out at 29 Palms taking a walk, and suddenly a flock of crows flew around my head, and I thought, this doesn't seem like a very auspicious thing, but I don't want to be superstitious, but there they were right around my head. And I didn't know anything about it, didn't think much about it, nothing to think about. But 2 days later, when I made up my bed, I was sleeping out on the terrace, and I found between the sheets a squashed black widow spider. I had somehow rolled over in my sleep, and the spider had been killed. But then, sometime later, I was in India, in the town of Puri. And I was setting up a microphone for a big event for my guru's birthday. And suddenly, I grabbed the microphone, and suddenly the entire current went through my body. It lifted me off the ground. And there's nothing you can do when that sort of thing happens because it tenses your muscles. So I would have grabbed the microphone harder. But in that split second, the fuse blew. And so my life was spared again. My heart was a little shaky for a couple of days. After that, I was fine. And the third time, it happened three times. I had a Lambretta that I bought in Italy, and I shipped it to India. I thought of myself as riding the Lambretta around the road of Delhi. I looked absolutely absurd on this thing, because I sit very straight, and there I was. But anyway, when I first got it from Italy, I opened the safe up, and the box up, and took out the Lambretta, and I turned the key. I sat on the seat and turned the key. Didn't realize it was in gear. I was in a bricked-in courtyard. And as soon as I turned the key, it just took off. And I had a split second to figure out what to do about it. Somehow I was able to get my foot on the gear and get it into neutral and put my foot on the brake and stopped that close to the wall. So three times in my life, my life has been threatened with instantaneous death. Talked about other tests which I have had. Everything in that book was actually completely true. I got another reading from a different kind of book, also written 5,000 years ago, rewritten 400 years ago, but in that one it said that you had karmic blocks owing to the fact of asking too many questions. And my guru often told me, you were too much of a doubter. You kept saying, is this so, is this not so, and so on. And that put up blocks, because if you're trying to do something, and then you ask yourself the question, should I do it, is it possible, and so on, that's a block. And so it said that you have been prevented from achieving your full potential for success in this life by these karmic blocks. And now those blocks are over, so everything should be glowing. Well, let's hope they are, because I've tried so hard, and sometimes it seems like for nothing. But this morning only, I was looking over my past and thinking of all the things that people have done to prevent me from doing anything. There was a bunch of women at Mount Washington who were in charge. No matter what suggestion I made, they vetoed it. I spent a whole year reorganizing the lessons. And after it was all through, they just said, let's go back to the old system. And again this happened to me. And I used to wonder why. Well, let's get back to that question. Has God a sense of humor? You know, if you can learn to laugh at life, it's easy to take things, but otherwise it's pretty hard. There was one time I was with Master, I call Yogananda my guru, I call him Master. And I was with him at a performance. It was put on by a bunch of spastics for their benefit. And it was a benefit performance, in other words. And there was a young man who had come from India who was a student and friend of Yogananda's brother. And so Yogananda put him up. He was a boxer by profession and a very presumptuous fellow. He came for 2 days and stayed for weeks and weeks. And at one point he sent a message upstairs saying that he didn't like the food. It was American and he was used to Indian food. So Master said nothing. He just sent him food from his own kitchen. But this is the kind of fellow he was. Anyway, he decided for this performance that he would be a dancer. Well, he was a boxer, and I suppose you dance in a boxing ring, but there are subtle differences. And it was the most ridiculous performance I've ever witnessed. Esther and I were sitting side by side, just tears of laughter rolling down our cheeks. One time I let out a little guffaw and Master said, don't. But he was supposed to play the part of a hunter hunting a deer. And he played both parts. So sometimes he was this ferocious hunter and sometimes he was this dainty deer. And he went on and on. At a certain point, he got completely out of touch with the rhythm. And he stopped the orchestra, walked down to the footloads, and apologized for the orchestra. He said, they're not professional musicians. They don't know what they're doing. But please bear with me. And he went back. Every time he danced around them, he'd go like this, exhorting them to be in time. It was he who was out of time. Anyway, he then, after endless ages, it seemed like he finally got the deer shot. And this deer was writhing in agony all over the stage. Finally it collapsed. And everybody clapped, more in relief than anything else. But we had forgotten he was also the hunter. And so we stooped down and picked this deer up and began this victory cakewalk. It was so funny. I can only try to describe it to you, but at a certain point, we saw somebody in the orchestra go like this to the sideline, and the curtain began to descend. And he looked over, and he saw this curtain coming on, and then you saw his feet striding furiously to give those people a piece of his mind. Well, here was the really touching thing. Master could see the absurdity of the occasion. It was really one of the funniest events I've ever witnessed. But he could also see it from the poor young man's point of view, that his ego was really outraged at the way he'd been treated. And later, Master said, I understand that he didn't laugh at him. He was seeing it from his point of view. This was the beautiful thing about living with a master. Whoever he was with, in some subtle way, he looked like that person. I saw him in a photograph with the president of Mexico, whose name at that time was Portes Gil. And Portes Gil was sort of like the name portly and sort of pompous looking. And Master standing there somehow looked portly and pompous looking. Well, you can think maybe he was portly, he was slightly. But then there was Amelita Gallico. She was the famous opera star singer in Italy. And she had a small, frail-looking body. And when he was standing next to her, in some strange way, he looked small and frail. And honestly, I tell you, I could never remember what he looked like. He always changed according to the... He was like a mirror. He told a story of Krishna. This artist was trying to capture Krishna. But Krishna's face kept changing. And finally, the artist said, I know what I can do. They got a mirror and held it up before him. And no matter how much Krishna changed, the image in the mirror always reflected that change. So what Master was really a mirror to other people. It was quite extraordinary to see it. I had to remember, I lived with him, I saw him day after day, but I had to see a photograph to remember what he looked like. It was somehow, he reflected back to us, not who we were. In other words, if you were angry, he wouldn't look angry. But he would look back to you as if he were your higher self, looking at that anger and saying, is that really what I want? See what I mean? Even when you were negative, there was something in him that would make you see, oh, I myself don't like this. I saw somebody acting very presumptuous in his presence. And he looked at that person in such a way that that person realized, no, there's something wrong with me. I noticed that he often would somehow reflect back who I was. I'd see myself in him. Fortunately, I didn't mind myself. I wasn't that bad. But nonetheless, it was amazing how we can reflect back my consciousness. This is God's consciousness. And it's a beautiful thing to see. But underneath it all, what I noticed in his eyes was this unchanging bliss. And that bliss is the underlying reality of everything there is. And so, if I look back over the difficulties that I've had, as I say, we've all had them. And if I reflect on the humor of it all, it becomes quite funny how many people try their best to put me down. And it was just evidently my karma for that period of time. But I was thrown out of that organization. I was a monk. And they threw me out for my egotism, as they considered it. Well, I don't think I'm a particularly egotistical person. In fact, Master one time said, you will never fall due to ego. But somehow they saw it that way, because I was so enthusiastic and so creative and always doing new things, coming up with new ideas. They got exasperated that when they threw me out, they were saying, never again will we have to think about all those ideas hatched in that fertile brain of yours, as if it were a fault. But if I look back now, and look back not with tears of frustration, but with joy, I can see really there was a certain comedy in the consistency of it. It becomes quite funny. When you look back over all your lives and you think of all the hardships you've had to go through, there's a funny aspect to them all, and there's a joyful aspect to them all. Do you know, one time he was with Miramath, one of the disciples, and a few others, at a public performance of some kind, and he noticed that Mira kept looking at this little girl about 3 years old sitting right in front of her in their hand. And he said afterwards, I kept seeing you looking at that little girl. And Mira said, yes, I couldn't take my eyes off her. There was something about her that just fascinated me. So he just said casually, he knew all these things, but he didn't talk about them. He said casually, she died in a concentration camp in Germany in the Second World War. And because of her saintly behavior, she's become a saint in this life. And so you see the sadness, but you see the underlying beatitude also. So when you have to face even the most difficult times, if you can face them with the right spirit, if you can learn to have a good smile on your face, bliss is not only a reaction, it is the reality underlying everything. And a sense of humor, if it's caustic, if it's sarcastic, if it's unkind, that's not the kind of humor I'm talking about. But there is a certain humor in life that shows you that underlying everything, God is having a good laugh. And it may seem funny that he should laugh sometimes, and yet when you think that even this comes, you know, you're going to have obstacles, you're going to have troubles, you're going to be in concentration camps and everything. But at the end, you suddenly realize that it's all been a part of just a dream. This life is a dream. You're born into this life to understand that there is nothing real in it. You're born, you go through your troubles, you go through your ups and downs, but notice this, that every up is canceled by a down. Every down is canceled by an up. Everything is balances itself out. For there is duality, there is equality. For every wave on the ocean, there is a dip. It never changes the level of the ocean. You could have the highest wave possible. Some people were telling me in Hilo on the island of Hawaii that when they had that huge tsunami many years ago, for a while the water was sucked out and people were seeing all these beautiful little shells and so on, and they were drawn into them and picking them up, not realizing that now that suddenly a big wave would come which would drown them all. But this is how as life is. For every wave, you can't change the level of the ocean. There will always be a corresponding trough. And for every up in your life, there will be a corresponding down. It'll all even itself out in the end. And if your whole life is tragic, and this does sometimes happen, even that is temporary. Your difficult life in this life may become a glorious life in another. There's some girl I know of who was very ugly in a past life. Now in this life, she's beautiful. But it all changes in this way. Remember that if you look at life with a certain amount of detachment. Somebody asked me this question the other day. I was in Encinitas and I gave a talk there. And this person asked me, why should you not be attached? Because if you're not attached, you can enjoy everything. And if you are attached, you can't enjoy anything. You're always afraid of losing it. Like that Spanish song, Bésame mucho como si fuera esta noche la última vez. Kiss me as if this were the last time. Even in the moments of life's fulfillment, there's pain in the thought of losing them. And even when you find things, there's pain that, well, but it won't last. And when you lose things, there's hope that someday it'll all come back. Life goes up and down, up and down. It always evens itself out. Non-attachment helps you to step back from those outer realities. This is one of the basic teachings of the great Indian scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Nishkam karma, action without desire for the fruits of that action. We should act in this world, but always be detached. The truth is you'll succeed much more if you are detached, because then you won't be wasting energy on worrying about the outcome. Just do your best and leave the results in God's hands. I found that works so much better. You can always be happy under such circumstances. And when things go well, fine. And when they go badly, what a good show it is anyway. If you're not attached, then this world will give you nothing because you will have everything. When you live in that inner bliss, nothing can touch you. How is it that some people, from the beginning of life, anything they touch succeeds. Other people, anything they touch fails. This is a story Yogananda told about a man who used to be very devoted to God, was always poor, hardly had enough money to live on, and lived in rags. And a friend of his, everything he did was, it flourished, he was rich, he was healthy, he was well-liked, everything went beautifully. And if this was a true story or not, I don't know. But it could easily have been so. The poor man was a devotee. He loved God. And the rich man was not a devotee. He did not love God. In fact, he just gloried in tricking people out of their money. And he used to say to this devotee, what are you wasting your life on with all this holy practices? Why don't you just have common sense? Do what works, and if you get away with it, what does it matter? And this devotee said, I can't do that. So finally the rich man proposed to him, listen, let's make a test case. On a certain day, if by that day your way works and mine doesn't, then I will listen to you. But until that happens, I can't. Well, as it happened, that very day was the day that the rich man got a sudden windfall. And he was richer than ever. Whereas the poor man lost everything. And he was just desperate because he said, I can't live that way that my rich friend does. I can't live dishonestly. I can't live just for myself. And he prayed to God, please help me to understand. And God sent an angel to explain to him. He said, in your last life, you were just like him. And you had all these benefits and were rich, but you were ruthless. And at the end of your life, you decided, I don't like living this way. It's not making me happy. And I will live my life for God. And the other man was living a good life, but he decided that he was tired of it, so he decided to live a bad life. But this is the day of final payoff, as it happens for both of you. And so he was to get final riches, and you were to get your final test. But from now on, you will see everything change. And so this man, who was so discouraged, took hope again. And in fact, that's the way it happened. From then on, everything began to improve. Now, if you've been going through a period in your life where everything seems dark, nothing seems to work, such things happen. Of course they happen. And I've had it in my life where nothing seemed to work for ages. Everything I tried to do had opposition, scorn, everything I could imagine. I knew that I was doing a good thing. And yet it was just thrown into the dustbin. And I have just fought and stood there and stood my ground. And finally things have worked around to the point where things are going very nicely for me. But this is all karma. Karma is a very complex law. Because every time you have this, any kind of movement, karma means action. And so for any kind of movement, as this is the law of Newton, isn't it? For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And everything, if every movement that you make in this direction, there is another movement in the opposite direction. This law penetrates to all levels of life. Whatever you do, remember, it will have consequences. So be sure to act in such a way. I always say that there are two good reasons for living rightly. One is that you are more happy when you do, and the other is that living rightly works and living wrongly doesn't work in the end. And the joke of it is, Yogananda described it as the thwarting cross currents of ego. So because we have so many currents going out, when people become more spiritual, every action receives a much more instantaneous reaction. But for most people, their minds are such a jumble of so many energies going out that a bad action today may seem to result in a good action because of a good action yesterday. It is helpful in such cases not just to rely on your own experience. Rely more on the wisdom of the ages. If people over thousands of years have been declaring that this is a truth, and if their lives show them to be wise, it's good to listen to them and not say, oh, I'll show you. Because there are some people who understand, as most people don't. I realized when I was seeking truth that I had reached the point where I desperately needed help. Nothing I did, it was sort of like washing a dirty shirt. A bubble would form in the shirt, and I'd try to push it down here, it would just move over here. So I'd work on one quality and try to overcome this quality, and while I was putting all my energy there, some other quality would rear its ugly head. And it just was an endless task. And I finally reached the point of thinking, I need help. I don't know what to do about it. I'm doing my best. But I keep stumbling. And it takes so much energy to change. I remember I was 21 at the time. But I was thinking deeply about life. And I reached the point where I decided that there's only one reality in God in life, and that's God. And therefore, I must give my life to God. I didn't know if I was going crazy, because it seemed to me that I'd never read about saints. I didn't know such people existed. But I knew that for me, even if I went crazy, this is what I had to do, But I didn't know how to do it. And I decided that I would at least go out in the jungle. I had wanted to be a playwright. I had wanted to be a famous playwright. I had wanted to do good with my plays. And I thought, how much good has plays done anybody? They don't change people's lives. And I thought, why do something that's just a waste of time? And then I thought, well, I want to teach people truth, but I don't know truth. So why should I flood the world with my ignorance? And so I decided to give up everything and seek God. But I smoked. And I thought, well, whoever heard of a hermit who smokes? Where are you going to get your cigarettes? Where are you going to get the money to go out and buy cigarettes? And I decided I've got to give up smoking. So I found it like Mark Twain, the easiest habit in the world to give up. As he said, I've done it 1,000 times. Well, I gave it up in the morning and I'd pick it up again at lunch. And each time I failed, I never told myself, you've failed. I've always said, I haven't yet succeeded. Please remember that statement, because it'll help you very much in your life. Every time you fail in a goal, never tell yourself, I'm a failure. Tell yourself, I haven't yet succeeded. You can succeed in the end. Your goal, your destiny is to become perfect. Jesus Christ said, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. And most or many translations of the Bible have changed that because they can't imagine man being as perfect as God. So they say, be good, just as God is good, or some other word that will take the place. But really what Jesus said was, be ye perfect. God wants us to become like him because we are a part of him. We are his manifestation. We are manifestations of his bliss. We have to understand that what he is, we must become. Actually, there's a very human side to God. And this also is what great masters, when they come into this world, help us to understand. God does have a sense of humor. It's kindly, but it's true. There are certain aspects of God that are, in human terms, very real, hard to describe. But you find that the closer you feel to him, the more you realize that he is consciously each person walking down that street, each person looking for that same bliss. Each person in the end will find that bliss. And so in this struggling, you will find that, yes, there are times when it's very difficult and other times when it's good. But if you can keep that detachment from it, if you can say, all right, I know that things aren't as they might be and will be, but in the meantime, let me at least not be touched by it. Nishkam karma, action without desire for the fruits of action. Just understand that whatever happens to you in life, it's temporary. I said at the beginning, old age, the best thing about it is that it's temporary. You don't die when your body dies. There's too much mind power there, holding things together. The body won't be there, but that personality with that ego and the personality spinning around that ego, this is an energy in the universe that can't let go. You will continue. You will be yourself in the other world. And if you've been an unpleasant person, you'll be an unpleasant person there. It's not as suddenly you become wise. You'll be the same person. And it takes many, many lifetimes. Why is there reincarnation? Well, let's put it this way. There are no cigarettes in heaven. If you like smoking, you'll have to come back here where there are cigarettes. By my refusal to accept that I had failed, finally, after a year, reached the point where I told one of my roommates, I've quit smoking. And he said, oh, I've heard that one before. But I had. The next morning, I had not the slightest desire for a cigarette. I've never had such a desire ever since then. Once I dreamed that I had smoked. That was the closest I came to having that desire, and I felt very guilty. But that guilt is something we have to overcome. So many people saying, "What, I'm a poor sinner." So Yogananda was at a gathering of Amy Semple McPherson, and she cried out for these thousands of people, "You're all sinners, get down on your knees." And Yogananda said afterwards, "I was the only one still standing because I would not admit that I'm a sinner." Don't tell yourself that you failed. Don't tell yourself that you're a sinner. Don't tell yourself that you have these qualities which may be really deep-seated in you. Don't say, "These are mine, this defines who I am." Really, you don't need to. The joke of it all is that when you overcome a quality, even something deep-seated in you, when you finally overcome it, you just look back and you wonder what all the excitement was. It just seems so absurd that you got into it in the first place. The drunkard will someday think, "Why did I ever drink? It's not even pleasant tasting." You are not your faults. You are not your present personality. You are not this person who likes to get angry or feels jealous or feels whatever quality that he may have that is negative. None of these things is you. You are really the perfect being inside, trying its experiments through many lifetimes to find what works. And it takes lifetimes to find out what works. You may in one lifetime think, "Well, drinking is a swell thing. I just love it." But after a while, you begin to notice that it brings you great suffering. And so you work to overcome it. It may take several lifetimes before you overcome it. You know, some people, they just take one drink and immediately they become alcoholic. Why? Medical science tries to offer some explanation of certain, I don't know what the name is, in the blood that makes you that way. No, it's not that. It's that in your last life you were alcoholic. Therefore, Yogananda said, never drink. Even if you think you can keep it under moderation, you don't know what your past has been. Just leave it alone. You don't need to drink to be happy. And leave bad habits alone. Don't play with them. In some people, they're deep-seated. And the first experience, the first taste they get of it, and they become avid for it. How many lifetimes it takes to reach perfection on all levels to the point where you don't need sex, you don't need money, you don't need liquor, you don't need fame, you don't need all the things that people want in this world. The three main ones are sex, wine, and money. Sex is something very close and close to us and something that we feel more directly, and so it seems more real. And so people get involved in it. And if this person doesn't work out, if this girl or this boy doesn't work out, well, another one will. And so you can go for lifetimes thinking this one, this one, this one. Like that story I've often told about a man in the World War II boot camp who was going around picking up pieces of paper and saying, "This isn't it, this isn't it, this isn't it." Finally, people decided he needed to go to the camp psychiatrist. And in the psychiatrist's office also, he was picking up pieces of paper and, "This isn't it, this isn't it." Couldn't even get the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist couldn't even get him to respond to him. So finally, he recommended him for a medical discharge. And as soon as he got that medical discharge, he said, "This is it." And so you go through life looking for all the things that you think will work, and this doesn't work, that doesn't work, the other thing doesn't work. But there is some little point inside you, and it can take a long time before you realize this, because the human capacity for error is very great. One time a disciple said to my guru, "I don't think I have very good karma, Master." And Master very seriously said, "Remember this. It takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God." People think that to find satisfaction first in so many things before they realize that it's all part of a big package. We're all part of something much bigger. When I reached that point of knowing that I needed God and I needed help, you know, as they say, you lift one hand to God, He drops to pick you up. God is there too, and He will help you if you call to Him. Try it. Americans love experimentation. Why not try this experiment? Bring Him into your life. Try to talk to Him. Try to share with Him the things you've experienced and the things you've done. You'll find that it does work. When I was seriously seeking God, after I had given up trying everything else because nothing seemed to work, I remember my father was sent to Egypt. He was an oil geologist for Esso, which is now as Exxon. And he was sent to Egypt to explore for oil. And what helps me to see that this was God working was that he didn't find oil there. He found where it would be. He knew exactly where they should drill, but his company changed its mind and brought him back and sent him to France. So he was sent all the way to Egypt, really for no reason but my sake. That's the way I read it. So there he was, a skeptical American who would have done his best to keep me from going to Yogananda. The day I put my mother on the ship was the day I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And that book absolutely changed my mind. If you haven't read the book, please do. It's the greatest book I've read in my life. But it was just thrilling to read. Not it was full of miracles and wonders and all sorts of things, but what really impressed me more than anything else was how beautifully he responded to every situation in life. I thought, this man, of all the people I've ever met in my life, this man I can follow. And I took the next bus across the country. I knew nothing about Indian philosophy. A week before I went to him, I'd never heard the word yoga or karma or dharma or all the common words that nowadays everybody knows. This was back in 1948. And these words weren't so known then. I was completely ignorant. But as I read his book, I knew this was what I had to do. And I remember crossing the country and thinking, this is a wonderful message. I wish the whole world knew about it. And I had never wanted to follow anybody because I never felt there was anybody worth following. But the first words I addressed to him were, I want to be your disciple. That was more than 62 years ago, and I've followed him ever since. And I want it clearly understood that what I was following was more than him. It was a principle. We have all come from that one reality, and our reality, however we find it, must be the same. It doesn't mean you've got to go to this saint or that saint. I always say, I'm here to convert you to, I don't want to convert you to anything except to your own higher self. And how you find that self is your business. I'm not trying to push anything over on anyone, but I do want you to be blissful. I do want you to find something so deeply worthwhile because it's what you're looking for too. And most people don't know. If I can help in that way, then my life is fulfilled. This is the purpose for my living. And as I lived with him, I came to understand. I lived with him for 3.5 years, and I came to understand what a great truth this is. It can change the life of every human being, every insect even, because everything in this universe sings with God. The sound of his vibration is everywhere. This is a truth. So, if you will be detached, if you will have a sense of humor, if you will look at your ups and downs in life and be able to laugh at them, after all, they're not that serious. And if nothing else, you'll leave them with death at least. Don't worry about it. You will find that if you have that attitude, everything suddenly will start to smile on you. Everything gets better. Your boss won't treat you so harshly as he's been doing. Your co-workers will be more cooperative. The thing is, the kind of energy you want is the kind of energy you'll get back. And if, instead of scowling at your neighbors, you treat them kindly, they will treat you kindly. There was a man who was the sort of village grouch, and he snarled at the boys who crossed his lawn, and he cursed everybody, and he was always angry and always upset. And one day, he came out of his house smiling, happy. Finally, after about a week, of a whole delegation of people in the village came to his house. They said, "We're all wondering what's happened to you." And he said, "You know, I got so tired of trying things that never worked. The world never went the way I wanted it to, no matter how I tried. I decided I'd just start enjoying myself." And why don't you just start enjoying yourself? Enjoy whatever comes to you. And if tragedy seems to come, it's not really tragedy. Look at the others and you'll find out that it worked out just the way it had to. Death works out just the way it has to. You know, there's one woman at Ananda Village now who's on the point of death, and her brain is just completely frazzled. There's all sorts of things going on, tumors and so on. There's just no hope for her. And she's taking it very calmly, very peacefully, and she says it's just right. And I have seen over the years, she had cancer of the breast years ago, and she got chemotherapy and had to go through a great deal of pain from that. But now she's reached a point of maturity where nothing can touch her. It is so thrilling to see people reach that point of understanding where death itself is welcome. It doesn't matter. You know that you have accomplished what you needed to accomplish. You know that you are who you want to be. And with all of this, you'll see that underlying all of life, there is bliss. Life itself is, well, at the end of it all, when you've gone through all this long trail seeking whom you and who you really are, then you will understand that it was well worth it. Every saint who ever found God said it was well worth it. So now we've reached the point where I really ought to shut up so I can let you ask questions. So let me do so. And Narayan, you come up here. And because I'm deaf as a post, he can help me to understand if I don't hear you properly. So, any questions? Yes.
Yes, Swami. It seems to me that when Master did not appoint a successor, since then it's caused a lot of conflict and division among devotees. So my question is, why was Yogananda the last of the lineage?
Yogananda said he was the last of this line of gurus. That was because God at this time sent... You know, what happens is this, that when the soul reaches liberation, almost everybody, once they're through with everything, they've paid off all their past karmas. You know, you can reach oneness with God and still have past karma to get rid of. And most of the saints in autobiography of a yogi were not fully liberated. They still had past karmas to work off. But once you've neutralized everything, once you've seen yourself as a pirate in some past life, and realized that it was God in that form who was playing his part, dreaming it all. Once you've seen that God did everything, and you merge finally back into oneness with God, you become God. There's no difference between you and God. But most people look back and they say, I've worked hard enough for this. I'm happy where I am. I don't want to come back. There are very few people who have so much compassion that they come back from that state of final liberation to help other people. Such people are called avatar. This is the true meaning of avatar, quite different from the modern use of that word, which becomes almost comical by comparison. Truly meaning, truly spoken, an avatar is one who has attained final liberation and then retains that one little quality of compassion just so that he can come back and help other people. And when an avatar comes back, he is born with much more power, even than a liberated saint. He comes back with divine power to save thousands, millions of lives if need be. And such people are the ones who start the great religions. Jesus Christ was an avatar. Buddha was an avatar. Krishna was an avatar. Truly speaking, an avatar usually has a great world mission to fulfill. So we have a line of avatars who brought this mission into the world. It was time. Yogananda explained it this way. He said that Jesus appeared to Babaji, and he said, what is happening to my religion? He said, they do good work, but they have forgotten the most important thing of all, which is communion with God. And he said, let us send back to the West a mission that will tell people about inner communion, not just outer communion. I remember, I'm going to take a sideline here just for the fun of it, and please bear with me if you think I should be more serious. But I remember once when I was 17, and it was a Christmas service, Christmas Eve service in my Episcopal church. They drink wine in the Episcopal church for the communion. And that line was very long, and I was getting very thirsty. As I approached the altar rail, that wine looked awfully good. And when the priest finally put the cup to my lips, I sort of gave it an extra nudge. And he tried to take it away, and he had to pull. So he pulled, and there was this loud sucking sound. So my devotional past is not necessarily as bright as one might expect. My brother kneeling next to me began giggling. But anyway, where was I?
the lineage of Jesus and Babaji.
So Babaji, Jesus appeared to Babaji, and they both of them sent Yogananda. My own suspicion, but it's not one he would want me to talk about, so I feel I'm not quite doing right in saying it. And yet, I feel right, too. And so, here I am on the horns of a dilemma. I asked him one time, sir, were you Jesus Christ? And he answered, what difference would it make? When we become one with God, we all become like Jesus Christ. One time, I was asked to play the part of Jesus in a play, and Master mentioned afterwards how people said I looked like Jesus. I said to him, well, sir, I'd rather be like him than look like him. And Master casually said, that will come. The thing is that it will come to all of us. He saw all of us as potential Christs. He saw our potential perfection, and that was what he worked with. So that when I told him that I'd rather be like him than look like him, he didn't laugh as I expected him to. He acted quite serious. This was his sacred responsibility to make all of us one with God, to lead us to our own liberation. And this to him was a serious matter. So anyway, Yogananda, I suspect, was Jesus, because I have worked on Yogananda's book, the Teachings of Jesus, The Secret Meaning. What do they call it? you know,
the second coming of Christ.
Yeah, but what is my book
Revelations
called?
Revelations of Christ.
Revelations of Christ.
I thought you would remember.
I mean, I really ought to know my own book. Nevertheless, I've written 140 of them. And
it's on sale.
Well, anyway, when I wrote that book, I couldn't help feeling that Yogananda's personality was very much like that of Jesus. Jesus is thought of as gentle Jesus, sweet and mild. Think of how he drove the money changers out of the temple. No ordinary person could do that kind of thing. This was a sacred tradition. And yet he was able single-handedly to drive all those men out. He had power. And when the Pharisees addressed him and said that you were wrong in what you were doing, he said, you were sons of the devil. He could talk strongly. He was a man of great humor, too. And you see that humor repeatedly in the Bible. When you read it, hear it read, or hear it read on a Sunday, it sounds so solemn. But put yourself in that position and think about it. For example, one time they were all ready to stone him for saying that he and God were one. And he answered, hey, this takes a certain boldness. Put yourself in his position. There's a whole crowd of people ready to stone you to death. And he said, I've done many good things among you. For which one of these are you stoning me? That takes courage to answer that way, don't you think? He was laughing at them. Sometimes when this kind of thing happened, he would just disappear, dematerialize. But his life was a... After all, the young men around him were young men. They were full of energy. There are many points in the Bible where if you look at it realistically, you see that he had to be laughing when he said it. I've done many good things among you. For which one of these are you stoning me? That takes courage. Well, anyway, I've seen, because I knew Yogananda, and reading that book, I've seen how many ways he and Jesus and Master seem very similar. So yes, I think it is possible. When William the Conqueror, he answered a question once in a lecture of his, would Jesus have reincarnated? Would he have come again? Well, he said that anybody with that compassion would certainly come again and again. Jesus has come again. He's come again in the Christian world. You know, Yogananda said, and this to me was an absolute shock, because I had been raised in the English tradition. I was born in Romania of American parents and raised in English schools. And I had always thought of William the Conqueror as one of history's great villains. And Yogananda said he was William the Conqueror. And I thought, my God, Yogananda? William? But I, of course, had to do a lot of research because I couldn't let that one just sit there. And I found out that there were many points. Do you know that William the Conqueror's body was incorrupt over 400 years after he died? He was a great soul. But he had to work with a very dark period in life. But he came to bring back Christianity more than anything else, to bring back Christianity to the north. England, he brought England under the control of Rome because it was more truly Christian. He brought it away from the influence of the Norsemen. He founded and encouraged the foundation of many monasteries. And his son Henry, the same thing. These points are very interesting to contemplate. I think that he was also Fernando III, Ferdinand III of Spain. And at that time he was called a saint. And his body too is incorrupt. And I had a chance to meditate before they open it one day a year. And I had a chance last May to go to his tomb and meditate that day when they opened it up to the public. And his body is also still incorrupt. But there are many, you might say, fishy things going on in history It's a fascinating story. But I think that our line of gurus has come with a particular purpose. Babaji was Krishna, Yogananda said. And Yogananda's mission was to bring back the ancient teachings of the Bhagavad Gita and the original teachings of Jesus Christ. That was his mission in this life. So Babaji, Krishna, Lahiri Mahasaya, and Sri Yukteswar, all three of these were to bring this teaching back into the world. But this is a group of five avatars who came into this world, Jesus being the first. Yogananda said he was the last of these. He didn't mean the last guru, but he meant the last of the line. These are the ones who will have founded this new wave of spiritual inspiration that will change the world, is changing the world, is destined to do so. And you're on to a good thing here, I'll tell you that. Even though I don't want to convert anybody, I'll say stick with it. It's a good thing. Well, any other questions? Yes.
Hello, thank you. My name is Crystal. This is more of a personal nature for something I'm going through right now.
Tell me what she's saying.
Her name is Crystal, and this is more of a personal nature of what she's going through.
A nice name you have.
Thank you. I'm going through some fear right now. I'm in a big custody battle with my ex-husband. He's taken the children for a week of visitation. And
can you stop a moment?
She's going through fear right now. She's in a custody battle with her ex-husband.
Okay.
And he's a violent man. He's been abusive to me and to the children. I've had a restraining order against him. And it's because I haven't had money for a lawyer that he has the children right now.
So he's been violent and abusive. And because she does not have money for a lawyer, she's only been able to have a restraining order and the children are with the husband.
I did just get a lawyer. But the children with him. This morning, I was overcome at 11:20 a.m. with incredible fear, and my hand was just grabbing my other hand. It felt like a presence was with me. And I thought it was my mother, who was murdered by her husband. And then I just got so afraid for my children. And I'm so worried that they're in danger. And it's
so she's overcome with fear this morning. She was overcome with fear and she's afraid for her children. And she felt a presence this morning that was possibly her mother who was
murdered by her husband. And I guess I'm just seeking some sort of comfort to just, I don't know how to go through this.
She doesn't know how to go through it, Swamiji. She's seeking comfort.
You know, the only possible answer is to give this to God. Share it with him. I will pray for you. I'm very sad to hear this. But such is life, and it's good to know that this is true. Now, how can I give positive words after a story like that? I can't. And yet it does turn out positively in the end. The children have something to learn. Your mother had something to learn. Everybody in the end finds that these experiences, harsh as they are, ultimately are a cause for gratitude. I learned something then. I learned something from that experience. I learned to be kinder because I hadn't been kind enough. So many experiences, but right on the spot, you can't talk like that. And I can't give you such words of consolation except in the abstract. But it is true in the end. Right now, what you have to do is pray deeply to God for understanding and pray for your children and pray for your mother's soul. Because nobody dies. There's no such thing as death. But I am very sorry for that. And I will pray for you.
Getting my children back in a week from today. So yes. I just pray for their safety and protection.
I will pray.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes, there's a lady there.
Good morning. My question is, when one comes to the realization that there is nothing real in the world.
And stop every few moments.
When one comes to the realization that there's nothing real in the world.
Then how does one find meaning in the world? And
how does one find meaning in the world?
It's a dream, but you learn lessons from your dreams. I've had several dreams that have taught me those things. One of them, I had lived in a torture chamber. And I had spent my whole life in this torture chamber, and as far as I was concerned, that was the only kind of life there was. You woke up in the morning, and you were tortured, and you went to bed, and then you got up and were tortured, and you went to bed. And sometimes there were rather pleasant days when you were rather less tortured than usual. And I remember at one point a group of us got together, and we thought, this can't be the only way to live. And we plotted, and we finally rose up, killed our torturers, escaped from the building. And all this is a dream, mind you. We saw that the torture chamber was just the top story of a large building, and the whole building was empty. So once we've overcome our mental torturers, there's nothing left to overcome. And we came out and found ourselves on this vast plain, and we had thought that here this torture chamber was all of reality. It was just the top floor of a building in a vast empty plain. And we looked at each other, and then we looked up and we saw that the same torturers whom we had killed were walking around unconcernedly torturing people. And we were so surprised. And I remember turning to somebody next to me and I said, don't you see, it's ourselves we have overcome, not the torturers. And then I woke up. So you see, sometimes we have dreams that are very instructive. And so the dreams of this life may be instructive. I had another dream, quite more pleasant than this one. But I was flying. And I thought, well, this isn't something people do. Maybe I'm dreaming. So I tried to think it through logically, however, with dream logic. And with my dream logic, I came to the conclusion that I was actually flying. It was just doing something unusual, but it was real. And what was my surprise a moment later to wake up and realize that I had been dreaming after all. And so this world, which seems so real to every test we can make of it, is not real at all in the end. And when you die, you'll see your whole life, it just was a dream, it didn't really matter. So our dreams are not real, this life is not real, and yet the experiences that it teaches us, those are real in the sense that they help us to come back to our own home, to our own reality. Okay? Any other questions? Yes. Okay?
I really like your viewpoint on this.
I really like your viewpoint on this.
As opposed to attachment, could you explain to me what love is?
As opposed to attachment, can you please explain to me what love is?
Love is giving. Attachment is clinging. When you truly love, you think only in terms of the other person. What happens to you doesn't matter. So remember, the two differences, the essential difference is love is self-giving and attachment that is human love, is not real love. Human love is, I want you for me. I want you because I feel better when I'm with you. I want something from you. That's not good enough. There has to be this thought of, how can I give more? Not thinking in terms of anything that you will receive. That is God's love for us. He doesn't want anything from us, but he wants our love, yes, because he loves us. We will never be satisfied until we have discovered that love in ourselves. Okay? Any other questions? Yes.
Could you say something about the respective roles of the United States and India in the future spiritual development of this planet?
You know, this microphone ought to be turned higher.
Yeah, that one.
What did he say?
It was off. He said, can you speak about the respective roles of the United States and India working together for the future development of the world?
You know, Yogananda made this prediction. He said that someday America and India would join hands. India would represent the spiritual mass in man's nature, and America the materialistic. And these two together are essential for human advancement. So he said that in the future, these two countries would lead the world to prosperity. But between now and then, we have a long road to hoe. We have much suffering to go through, I'm sorry to say. What will happen, for example, with this economy if it gets so bad that trucks can't get into the inner cities with food because people on the outside of the cities are grabbing that food for themselves? This happened only a year ago in Detroit when a truck had to come into the inner city with two guns on either side, protecting it from other people so they could bring that food into the city. What will happen when this becomes serious? And it's going to. You won't have the comfort. How do you get money to, how do you get food into inner Los Angeles? How do you get it to the outskirts of Los Angeles when nobody has it? I would say, please take seriously what Yogananda said. Get some land in the country where you can grow your own food. We're coming to a time of hyperinflation. I read a financial newsletter the other day that says that hyperinflation is something that could occur almost overnight. And the dollar, Meister said, would someday not be worth the paper it's printed on. There are two types of depression, when you don't have money and when you have money but can't use it. This has happened already in just the past century. Argentina went through it, Germany went through it, other countries have gone through it. And the world is destined to go through it this time. We must realize that food is the main thing. What we'll find is a breakup of large cities into small communities where people work together, live together, seek a better way of life together. The sufferings that come to this world are, in this case, it will be because of avarice. People doing anything and everything to get money, they will have to suffer because of this. But as a result of it, too, they will become more generous. They will begin to think more in terms of other people. Communities, small communities, will be the web of the future. And this ideal, Yogananda said, will spread like wildfire throughout the world. I have started the first of such communities. And in the more than 40 years that we've been functioning, we have proved that people can live together happily, supportively, kindly, helping one another, and finding peace of mind, which they don't get when they only think in terms of, well, the kind of life you've had to live. People fighting each other like cats and dogs. I've introduced a sour note into this talk, but I must say, I would take it very seriously because the economy is not going to improve. It's going to just completely collapse. Yogananda said that the big depression of the 1930s will be nothing compared to this. This will be far worse. Do take my word seriously. Well, with that cheerful note, we're at the end of our talk.